Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 112 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. You can join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm. Or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. A little bit of feedback on episode 111 on global warming with Judith Curry. Bill, via email, wrote, "Thank you for your PRN show today on global warming. I couldn't believe the Progressive Radio Network was playing a show questioning global warming." If I can interject, I just think this is my job to evaluate and consider alternative views in every corner of science. Justin, via email, similarly wrote, "Just a quick note to say that I appreciated the climate change episode. Climate change is a topic that desperately needs more people like you trying to separate the dogma from the facts, complexities, and uncertainties. Judith seemed like an intelligent and informed guest for that purpose, although not very forthcoming. It sounded like a difficult interview." I think we got a lot of good information out in that interview, but I would certainly like to interview somebody else who had a different perspective on the issue. I found Judith's opinion reasonably rounded. She didn't try to deny that humans are having any impact on the climate. She was merely saying, is the impact going to be catastrophic? Or in some cases, could the impact even be positive in cold parts of the planet, such as Canada, where I live? Warming may have more benefits than detriments. It's really hard to say. If the human component is even significant enough to really make a difference, given the dramatic increases in climate that occurred without any assistance from human beings. Third, John Whitehead is an attorney and author who has written, debated, and practiced widely in the area of constitutional law and human rights. He graduated from the University of Arkansas School of Law with a doctorate in 1974. His concern for the persecuted and oppressed led him in 1982 to establish the Rutherford Institute, a nonprofit civil liberties and human rights organization based in Charlottesville, Virginia. He gained international renown as the result of his role as co-counsel in Paula Jones' sexual harassment lawsuit against President Clinton. He continues to speak out in defense of a woman's right to be free from sexual harassment and frequently comments on a variety of legal issues in the national media. He's the author of numerous books on a variety of legal and social issues, as well as pamphlets and brochures providing legal information to the general public. Whitehead has also written numerous magazine and journal articles. He wrote and directed the documentary video series Grasping for Wind, as well as its companion book, which focused on key cultural events of the 20th century. The series received two Silver World Medals at the New York Film and Video Festival. He's also filed numerous amicus briefs before the U.S. Supreme Court, has been co-counsel in several landmark Supreme Court cases as well, and his law reviews have been published in several major law journals. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thanks for having me on, sir.
Yeah. So let's talk about Paula Jones. That was a long time ago, but with Hillary Clinton just receiving the Democratic presidential nomination, maybe we should talk about what happened to Paula Jones. What was the outcome of the court case? What did she claim Bill Clinton did to her?
Well, Paula Jones, again, the Rutherford Institute, we're a legal organization. We take on cases and we take them on. We don't charge. We're a nonprofit and mm-hmm. we provide legal expenses. she had contacted us in early 1997, as I remember, about her situation. I interviewed her, and several of our other lawyers interviewed her, and a law firm actually came in. Actually, we interviewed her and decided what she, you know, what she was saying was credible. Since we also contacted some other women who had made similar allegations, she claimed that in a Little Rock hotel, President Clinton had exposed himself to her and basically asked for sex, oral sex, and she was greatly intimidated by it, and she didn't understand what was happening and was very, very confused. And she contacted us, and again, I said, we did some research. In fact, well, in the process of the case, we filed a lawsuit on her behalf,
right.
A sexual harassment lawsuit, and did depositions where we sat in rooms and talked to a number of women who had very similar stories, some claiming rape and things like that. And we filed the lawsuit. We took it up to the Federal Court of Appeals. The Federal Court of Appeals ruled in our favor, by the way. We were demanding that the president would have to take the stand.
Right.
He didn't want to do that.
No, I can imagine.
And what happened was the judges really had to take the stand. He immediately reached out to our lawyers. His lawyers did and wanted to settle the case. And
well,
we settled out of court for $1 million.
Right. And what was the relationship between Paula Jones and Bill Clinton? Like, why were they ever together in the first place?
Well, she was, like, working in the lobby of a hotel in Little Rock. He came in, he saw her. This was a familiar pattern, by the way.
Okay.
And he, you know, invited her up to his room. She did. And that's when the situation happened. But we had a number of women who came forward and said that, and basically he had a psychopathological condition. If a woman looked at him in any way, like smiled, he took it as a come-on, and he was ready for sex. He actually touched and fondled women. All that came out. All that was true. And, again, you don't sell a court for $1 million.
No.
Unless you got something to hide.
I think the money talks in that case.
Money talks in the case. What we saw, basically, I saw the power up close. Hillary was always part of the negotiations, and basically she ran the negotiations. I asked the lawyers one time, it was really strange. I looked across the table when they were negotiating. I said, well, what's the president going to do on this one? And one of the lawyers looked me in the eye and said, oh, he never makes any of the decisions. I said, what? I said, he says, Hillary makes all the decisions. And I went, okay. But at that time, just to give you an idea, this idea that she speaks out for women's rights and human rights,
right.
She was doing none of that. She was trying to hide most of this stuff.
Well, I was going to ask you that particularly because, you know, there's a lot of talk recently about how great it is that finally after, what is it, over 200 years, a woman has been nominated for a major party. There's been women nominated for minor parties before. And that certainly is great in principle. The question is whether this specific individual is going to be great for anybody's rights, women's rights, or anybody else's rights.
In my opinion, no, but I'm not political. You know, I don't get involved in politics. We're apolitical. But looking at Hillary Clinton, you know, it's just her record, what we saw, how she dealt with the women there. So the company, you know, basically what Bill Clinton needed was to be straightened up. I don't think he straightened up yet. That's my opinion. Nothing was ever done to the guy. So I think he does basically what he wants to do. They're very, very wealthy. In fact, to be honest with you, to give you the history here, I was a law student, third-year law student. He was a professor of criminal law at the University of Arkansas, and he was running for office. I did the first political interview with him. I sat down,
right.
I ate dinner with him. I went to his house, got to know him.
Right.
And was not, you know, again, he was a nice guy, but I wasn't impressed with his intellect. He's not an intellectual at all. And he knew me, and it was just strange that I wound up suing him. But, again, I had a history with Clinton, knew him, and heard stories at the time. But, you know, again, you're in college. You just dismiss that because everyone's doing weird things in college with women or whatever. But
right.
The point is that as President of the United States, he was obviously taking advantage of women, which was very, very unethical, in my opinion, illegal, and he should have been removed from office. He wasn't. You know, there was actually impeachment proceedings. The thing that boggles my mind is how everybody's forgotten this.
Yeah, I mean,
people were shocked, outraged, except for a lot of feminists who came to me and said, John, I agree with you. What he did was wrong, but I'm going to back him because he's, and I had them tell me this, big name feminist, he's the best thing we've got.
Which is maybe a sad commentary because, you know, he became powerful because he moved the Democratic Party to the right to try to take territory from the Republicans. And
yep.
So all the things like criminalization, welfare reform, his support for dictators around the world, I mean, he was outdoing the Republicans in that front.
Well, I agree with that. He's one of the first super global presidents. We're moving into a global, right now, global state. There's no doubt about that. And Hillary, I think if Hillary's elected, she's the probably the first, you might call, semi-global president of the world, yeah. Because talking to people around the world, again, I do interviews around the world with different journalists. For some reason, Canada, other countries, they worship the Clintons.
Yeah,
they really like the Clintons.
I think they're very popular. They don't really see the details. They also, I think, generally really love Obama,
yes.
who I think is genuinely a pretty nice guy and doesn't seem to have the record of Bill Clinton, but you know, his record on, he didn't close Guantanamo, he didn't end any of the wars.
He was the first president to have continual war for 8 years. He dropped 23,000 bombs in the Middle East.
Yes, his drone war.
The Nobel Peace Prize. He's a fraud.
That was embarrassing.
It's embarrassing.
I think even Obama might have been embarrassed by getting a peace prize for peace that he hadn't created yet and, in fact, never did create.
No, he's ignored. Seymour Hersh, the great journalist. Obama was in office a year, and I read an article about him, and he said basically, this is exactly what he said, Obama's in the hip pocket of the military-industrial complex. So he was a fraud from the beginning. But Hillary, by the way, Glenn Greenwald called her, she's an effing war-making bitch. That's an actual quote from the
That's not very nice, but it's probably true.
yeah, to please other countries, the Saudi Arabians, whoever she's dealing with at the time. By the way, you know, we're in a very strange situation, and much of this, by the way, and I'll say this, and I say it in my books, Battlefield America, which is my new book, The War Against American People, the American people are not taking a stand on these issues. They're thinking by voting, they're doing their political duty, but voting is the first step. I mean, you got to hold them accountable. If they say they're going to do this or do that, I'm not going to do this or that, Americans just sit back and watch TV and wait for the next election 4 years later, and then by then it's too late. In fact, I'd say we're so far down the road now that it is almost too late and far in terms of saving freedom as we used to know it in this country.
Well, I mean, let's talk about voting. You said, this is not maybe an exact quote, but you said something like, if voting made any difference, they wouldn't let us do it.
Yeah.
And so you're saying that if an American gets out there in November presses the buttons or pulls the lever or whatever is necessary to make a vote, that's not going to make
That's going to make any difference. The only thing that makes a difference, as I show it in my book, Battlefield America, and people who have done it, is getting back to local government, taking over your local governments, getting supervision over the SWAT teams. I don't know if you saw the case here a couple of days ago with the 76-year-old guy who was shot in his home by mistake and he's on now life support by a SWAT team.
I didn't hear about that one. I heard about a woman who was shot.
Over 80,000 SWAT teams are in this raids are taking place in this country. 80%, by the way, for what we're a warrant service for a policeman used to knock on your door. They're going through your doors. We live in a military state, and that's the point now. It's everything George Orwell, the great writer or the great fiction writers, wrote about, and they predicted it was coming because the American people were asleep.
Right.
So if you think voting is going to do anything, folks, it never really has because they ignore you. Listen, I work with journalists in Washington, D.C., and they tell me right into my face, they say, John, when these guys get elected, they begin immediately, the congressman or whatever, they begin immediately planning for their next campaign. In fact, one called me, he says, I was shocked when he got a job on Capitol Hill. He says, 2 days a week, they take the afternoons off these guys. We're paying them all these fancy flowers on their desks, free medical stuff. And he says they actually do fundraising 2 days a week on our money.
Right, right. I mean,
crook and corrupt, folks.
Yes. There's just so many things wrong with the system. I mean, when Americans go to vote in November, they're basically going to have a choice of Hillary or Trump. It seems like Bernie Sanders was eliminated through the fact that the party aligned with him. And I think the Republican Party was trying to get rid of Trump, but they just didn't seem to be able to do it because Trump just refused to play by the rules. But that's the choice. And the vast majority of people never got an opportunity to vote opportunity to vote on the other candidates. And then your other choice is a third party like Libertarian or Green, but everybody knows those won't win in the two-party system, so therefore, what's the point of voting for them? So people will
think about the system here, folks. I go to the store, I got a cold, I got 20 cold medicines to choose from. I go to the polls, I got a Republican or a Democrat.
Right.
Who set the system up like that? Why should we put up with it? But we do. We put up with it. We go along with it. We do the screaming at the rallies and all that.
Right.
And people always look at them and say, oh, he didn't live up to my expectations. Well, you got to make them do it. And you can make them do it. I mean, there were some great people in the past, as I show in my book, Battlefield America, that squared up and says, we ain't taking this no more. And they got picket signs, they got in the streets, and they fought back. But I don't see much of that today.
Well,
I mean, the Occupy movement in 2011 was a neat movement. I backed it.
Right.
It lasted 6 months.
Right.
Everybody
right.
went home.
Yes.
And you're still taking the crap.
And, you know, Black Lives Matter is the latest movement. The question is whether they can keep the pressure in the right way. Like in Canada, the Black Lives Matter movements made a huge deal about the police at Pride parades. They said, we're not going to go to Pride parades if there's police in the parade as opposed to on the street, which there will be at a big parade.
Yep.
It seemed like an incredibly minor issue to you know, not the hill you want to die on. There's people getting shot. There's black people getting shot in America and Canada. And there's criminalization. There's far more black people in jail for nonviolent drug offenses. Those are the big issues, I think.
Over 60% of the people are in our prisons in America are people of dark skin color, most of them black people for minor offenses, yes. And as I show in my book, most of the prisons are moving toward private prisons where they're making the prisoners work for Walmart, Microsoft. They're doing all kinds of things. And the women are working in the field 12, 13 hours a day.
Some people
for the profit of big corporations. So,
right.
And by the way, as I show in my book, Battlefield America, the Nazi concentration camps were private prisons. They made products for Europe.
They were run by private corporations, or they just allowed private corporations to profit from
private them? Corporations ran Auschwitz, yes. They made rubber products and all kinds of products for Europe, yes.
Well,
they're basically private prisons, yes.
I do want to talk more about things like the militarization of the police, but the reason I asked you to do this interview was because you documented a lot of cases where the American government had performed secret experiments on the American people. Some of the ones that you had listed were in Maryland, prisoners who were exposed to flu. In Connecticut, mental patients were injected with hepatitis. There were experiments with LSD, the MK Ultra experiments.
Yep.
You said more recently, DHS scientists were releasing unknown gases and particles on subway platforms.
Yeah, New York City, yeah.
So how well documented is this, and what was the justification for doing this?
Well, if you go to our website, it's called American Horror Story. It came out in May, my commentary. It's on this. I just have been researching. These are the sources for all this, Associated Press, NPR, but it comes out years later where they're doing... You know, in 1931, they started injecting cancer cells into some people, our government. In 1932, and I'm surprised most people don't know about these. This has been well publicized. A lot
right.
of African Americans upset by the Tuskegee syphilis study.
Right.
where 100, 200 black men were diagnosed with syphilis. They were never told it, and they were used as guinea pigs to see what type of symptoms, if it just carried out, you know, and they were never told this.
Can we talk about...
Gas has been dropped on American people. People should read the article. It's called American Horror Story. Go to our website at Rutherford.org.
Okay.
But the point is that, and one reason I write what I write is how our government views us. They view us basically as data now, or animals to be tested, and they all, you know, I mean, the Flint, Michigan, finding out there was lead in the water in Flint, Michigan, making people sick.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that wasn't exactly an experiment. That was a money-saving...
Not an experiment, but they don't tell you. They're doing
right.
Well, I don't know if it's an experiment or not. To be honest with you, as I look at things, and again, I go back, as I show, you know, the government I look at today is overtaxing me. It's not giving me freedom. If I make the wrong mistake, I can be put in prison. There are over 5,000 federal crimes, and there are different state crimes or local crimes. I mean, and we defend cases, you know, where people, you know, veterans who grow vegetable gardens at the Rutherford Institute, we had a case where it was illegal to have a vegetable garden.
Really?
In his backyard. The police came and arrived. We've had a number of cases where people have a single chicken in their backyard. It's a crime. People actually come and take the chickens away and say, if you get another one, we're going to arrest you and put you in jail. We've got a legion of cases like that. So what we're facing today is a government that's just there to make money off of you. I think they treat us like slaves.
Listen.
If you look at our history of revenue, this is all backed up by facts and mm-hmm. cases that we handle. Kids in school who today point their finger. We had a case for a kid named Johnny Jones. To give you an example of how bad it is, the schools have become, in my opinion, indoctrination centers.
Mm-hmm.
We had a young boy who went up to the teacher's desk. He was a 10-year-old to get a piece of paper. On his way back, his best friend in class did an imaginary gun with his finger.
Right.
No sound. Our kid made an imaginary bow and arrow. He was pulled out of class and cited with a weapons violation.
Which one? The one with the imaginary bow and arrow, or the one with the imaginary gun?
Yes. Well, we have a lot of those cases, though. I mean, I've talked to grade school kids who tell me that they have now 10 words they can't say or whatever, and I talked to them, and I was speaking to them, and I said, well, what's some of the words? One girl says, one word we definitely can't say is the G word, and I thought, oh, not the God thing anymore. She said, that's not that. And she says, I can't say. I said, could you write it down? She wrote down the word. It was guns. And I said, wait a second. How do you describe?
How do you discuss?
Are carrying over. I'm a veteran, by the way, an Army veteran. How do you describe what those guys are carrying over in Afghanistan? How do you describe what those policemen are carrying on their side if you can't say those words?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is the average American today, as I show in my book, Battlefield America, commits up to, you know, you can commit three crimes walking down the street now.
Well, I think that's very true, that in poorer parts of America, a lot of the budget of cities comes from basically harassing the citizenship for minor things. Yes, especially driving violations. And of course, in America, where often there isn't public transportation, you need a car, and if you can't afford insurance, you drive without insurance, and then you get hit with fines. Or you got a cracked windshield, because, of course, a windshield is expensive, too. So it's kind of a tax on the poor.
Or you have red light cameras in your neighborhood, and we've been involved in suits on that are frauds. They actually increase rear-end crashes, but that's how they make money when you make a so-called rolling turn. So the system is set up in this country. I mean, listen, I've been handling cases for 40 years. It's set up in this country basically to make money off the American citizen.
Okay, I want to go back to Tuskegee syphilis experiment. When was that?
1932.
Okay, so this is my problem with that. I think there's a double irony here, because in 1932, the treatment for syphilis was arsenic, mercury, and bismuth. I think those were the three metals. It was three mm-hmm. heavy metals. So the treatment for syphilis was incredibly toxic. It was not until World War II that penicillin became the treatment for syphilis. So in a sense, those men, they weren't being treated, but they were also avoiding incredibly toxic syphilis treatment. And I'm not.
The point is that they were never told they had the disease.
Right, right. I understand.
Only 74 out of 200 survived. They just watched them die.
But if they had treated them for syphilis, they would have died more quickly.
I don't know that, but you know, the doctors do everything. They diagnose you, they tell you what's wrong with you, and they do the best to save you. They don't watch you die. In other words, this is documented. They did a study to see the effects on these black guys.
I'm not saying that there was
They're not white guys. They're black guys.
Right, right.
Back in 1932, black people were seen as animals by many people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I totally understand that. It just seems like a double irony that people were deliberately withholding a drug that in actual fact was extremely toxic. And it's hard for me to see how...
Well, they were pretty clear they weren't doing it for that reason. They were studying the effects, how it would draw out, and they didn't even tell them they had syphilis.
Now, right.
What kind of people do that?
I totally agree that the intent was evil. But it seems to me that there is a double irony there.
There's irony in everything.
Yeah, I think. And also, you mentioned there were trials in Uganda where people were not given AZT. But AZT is an incredibly toxic drug. It's actually what they call a nucleoside analog, which interferes with DNA synthesis. So again, it's not really clear that having a drug that toxic withheld from you is actually a bad thing, but the intention was to gain profitable medical knowledge through a placebo-controlled trial. So I understand your point, but again,
that's what you do to pigs or dogs, not to people. Yeah.
Yes. Although there's a lot of questions.
You're talking to somebody that's very pro-human and very pro-freedom. I think your government there, if you're dealing with, or doctors are there to do the best they can to save your life, to make sure you make it through, whether it's with herbs, whatever way
right.
they can heal you. When they don't tell you intentionally you have disease to watch how you lie there and suffer, that sounds Nazi to me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I just think a lot of times in our medical system, when doctors believe they're helping, they have biased information from drug companies, and they may not realize that in many cases the drugs or treatments don't help.
Some doctors, yeah, most doctors are knowledgeable and they know what they're doing. I mean, how many people know that the United States government has put $81 million into teaching psychologists overseas, basically, working in CIA torture chambers, how to conduct torture? I mean, that's a well-known fact. What kind of people work? I mean, they've been heavily criticized for that by a lot of people,
mm-hmm.
if you read the articles, but what kind of people do that?
Yes.
These are Americans. Yes. Abu Ghraib, I'm telling people, go back and look at some of those photographs. There was a lot of torture going on, even with children.
Yes.
These are Americans doing it.
That is a real real question of how do people who started off as normal, good people end up doing such things.
I address that in my book, Battlefield America. If you look at it, it's called The Psychopathological State. I go into it, and this is documented by psychiatrists. For some reason, people that have a problem with pathology tend to move into politics and leadership. And one of the arguments of one of the psychologists in the book that I am in Battlefield America is that it passes down to the populace. And you can go back in history and look at Stalin, Hitler, and people like that. I've studied Nazi Germany very intimately, by the way. Listen, people stood and watched homeless people. That's what they started with, what they called asocials, putting them in concentration camps. They would march into the camps. The local people, like in Dachau, Auschwitz, were making money off of the products in the prison.
Right.
They just watched them march in, knowing that they were probably going to be there 3 weeks. They worked them to death.
Right.
Didn't feed them. Knowing that. Now, that pathology passes down. The question is, in our country, is it passing down to us? I'd say yes. When we can ignore a lot of the pain we're seeing and the things we're seeing in this country without being up in arms and ready to march down the street.
Well, I think the drone war is a good example of that.
Exactly.
I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, I know the American government just released statistics saying that they basically had killed hardly any civilians with drones, but anybody who's analyzed in any way knows that that's a total lie. And yet I
think...
Well,
you have the president sitting in his office on what he calls his kill Tuesdays and deciding who to drone next. And we do know. I mean, listen, I work with returning veterans. I'm an infantry officer myself. I have veterans that, you know, we defend veterans in some of those cases we might want to talk about.
Right.
They come back from Afghanistan and tell me horror stories of what's going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, I mean, it's
they're
just...
saying, hey, we're not over there fighting for freedom. We're over there fighting for money. I had one who told me, he was an Air Force pilot, decorated Air Force pilot. He sat in my office and said, I was shocked, and I could not do it again, he said, over there. He said, when he would drive by the opium fields, they were guarded by American troops. He said that he was so insulted. He got out of the Air Force.
Yes.
A warrior today defending people's freedom.
Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy on drugs because... The opiates are now a huge health problem, and yet most of them are pharmaceutically invented opiates. I mean, even heroin was invented by the Bayer Corporation in the late 1800s or early 1900s. But things like OxyContin caused horrible addiction problems in the general population.
And the FDA allows it, the Food and Drug Administration.
Right, and then they ban one, and then somebody creates another, and they claim that it's less addictive or has some other benefits, but the problem is still there. And somehow, if we grow opium poppies and produce pharmaceutical drugs, that would be a good thing, as opposed to producing illegal drugs. We never finished the discussion on the... gases and particles on subway platforms. What do we know about what the DHS was doing? When was it? What was the purpose?
It was about a month ago. We don't know. It was supposed to, you know, to test airborne particles. They didn't tell us much more than that. They just there was supposedly a warning, and they'd already done it in one case or two cases, basically. So.
Well, I remember.
I don't know exactly what happened with it now.
Right.
That when I saw that, I'd done some research into some of the experiments, and I said, hey, maybe I should write on this and alert people that this may not be a good idea. Because the people doing it, A, are not the smartest people in the world, and I'm not sure how careful they are in protecting us.
Well, I mean, I remember that there was an attack in the Japanese subway with sarin gas, so the idea that somebody could get into a subway and release a gas to kill people, that's certainly a potential, but very, I mean, I think it's only happened once, but it is a potential issue. But on the other hand, this, just as psychological research can be used to protect against torture or to actually torture, if you are studying the releases of gases and particles, you're also gathering information that could be used to develop chemical warfare as well.
Yes, you sure could.
I mean, I don't know how much you've studied this, but it seems like there are chemical warfare agents still basically being used, but through words, they're defined as not chemical warfare, like white phosphorus, or things that are sublethal, like tear gas and similar things like that.
Yeah. I went through all that in the Army, by the way.
You went through, like, being exposed?
Tear gas, all that stuff, and studied it, yeah. I was there. I was in the Army during the Vietnam War when I saw returning veterans coming back, Agent Orange and all that stuff. So.
And, I mean, do you have evidence that these experiments are designed to enrich private corporations? I mean, is this just the government?
We have no idea. No, there was nothing released. There was a notice given now. But we know the private corporations make the money. It's just like we just mentioned the Food and Drug Administration. I work with a number of people who have worked with the FDA, and they say it's the quick job into the big pharmaceutical industries. That's why that they don't regulate the pharmaceuticals carefully. They're not protecting us from GMO. They're not doing any of that stuff.
And often,
money to be made.
Right. Often the top people at the FDA or similar organizations come from private corporations or go back, or, you know, the revolving door, they may come from private corporations and go back afterwards. You almost wonder if those private corporations aren't subsidizing their their salaries when they're working for the government, because
they may be. I don't know. I don't trust the FDA because I see so much crap out there. And again, they're not. Again, they're not protecting the American people. And that offends me. I think, again, if I'm paying taxes, I want them to doing the best damn job they can to protect my freedoms and my health. And I don't see that today. No, I don't see it at all.
Yes.
I don't think the 80,000 SWAT team raids mean people getting shot in their hallways who have no weapons. The case of Jose Guerrero in Arizona, when the police were doing a sweep of marijuana in his neighborhood, they crashed through his door at night. He was a decorated Marine. He stood at the end of his hallway with his only thing he had was a hunting rifle. He thought burglars were coming in the hallway.
Right,
shot him 50 times.
Wow.
We see those cases almost every day. And that's what I'm saying is, if we want to change things in your local communities, you can get supervision over those SWAT teams and tell them, hey, if it's not an emergency situation, knock on the door with a warrant.
And
they're not doing that.
I mean, the one thing that came out maybe a year, or the first time I heard about it was about a year ago, was that the American government is kind of getting rid of fairly new but surplus military equipment on police forces. And then I heard that Obama said he wasn't going to do that anymore, and then recently I heard he changed his mind.
He's reversing his policy, yeah. But listen, we did our research at Ruff Institute. 60% of that equipment is brand new.
So police forces are purchasing this equipment.
They're getting a lot of dough.
Right.
The federal government's paying for it. DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is handing out a lot of it. And what most people don't know right now is that $71 million has been spent on the federal agencies. They all have super SWAT teams now. The Drug Enforcement Agency, the FDA has one. The IRS has a basically an army. The Veterans Affairs, the Smithsonian Institution. There's 120,000.
The Smithsonian Institution has a SWAT team?
Yes, they do.
What the heck are they going to do?
That's a good question. There are now at least 120,000 armed federal agents carrying, they have riot helmets, shields, cannon launchers, firearms, and driving tanks. And what in the hell for? Crime in America, by the way, is at a 40-year low, according to the FBI.
And whenever I see, a peaceful demonstration, I mean, I understand that a peaceful demonstration can become a riot if things go off the rails. But I always thought that the approach was that the police should show up and not provoke through over militarization. But now they show up with armored cars and riot equipment, even if the protest stays peaceful.
Well, too, but it's the old action reaction syndrome. People react to how the police are dressed often in the riot gear, the black uniforms, how the police are authoritative. They speak down to people.
Right.
I talk to policemen who say they disagree with all that. They don't know what to do about it. But it comes out of the academies, the police academies. I have friends who teach in the police academies. I have one who teaches the Fourth Amendment. He told me once, he says, John, I'm known as the anti-cop. And I said, why? He says, I teach the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, which most Americans don't know much about, is that the police can't do surveillance on you, touch you, or whatever without a probable cause or some evidence of crime, but they do it anyway. But they're trained very militarily now, so they react to us the way the military does over in Afghanistan. In fact, I've had some recent people over in Afghanistan said, hey, we don't react that way. We're surprised how American policemen react to American citizens.
I mean, there just seems like every week there's another case. Like there was the really absurd case of an autistic man with a truck in the street and a counselor trying to calm him down, and the police came and shot the counselor, and their excuse was, we were trying to shoot the autistic man to protect you. Which seemed like about the worst.
Well, let me ask this question. I've asked this other police officer. They look dumbfounded. What happened to tasers? Why are you shooting people when you can taser them 90% of the time? They agree. 90% of the cases, they could taser the people.
I mean, I guess if you want...
They pull their guns first. That's how they're trained.
Right.
I mean, I'm in the academies. Yeah, it's very military.
But, on the other hand, they've killed people with tasers as well.
Yes, but not like, and you know that, it's a very low count. But tasers I don't agree with either, no.
Yes.
But it's a much better way than blowing somebody away for nothing, yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Do it properly, yes. A lot of cops taser and retaser. You only have to do it once. I have friends who've been tasered. They've gone through training, policemen. They say one shot from a taser, man.
Right. And
you go down wiggling, yeah.
Right. There was a famous case in Canada at the Vancouver airport where a Polish man was basically lost in the airport. He didn't speak any English, and he was getting very upset because he couldn't find his way out. Nobody was helping him, and he started throwing a chair around or something, and the police came and tasered him multiple times, and he ended up dying, which became a big scandal in Canada. But it was just a guy was disturbed, and it was only a chair, right? It wasn't like he was wielding an axe or he had a gun.
It goes back to the training. Policemen, when I was growing up as a younger man, there was none of that stuff.
Well, it seems
in the uniforms, so the black color is the authoritarian color. When I was growing up, it was either a blue uniform or a brown uniform. My next-door neighbor was the chief of police. I asked him one day why I didn't carry a gun. He looked at me and says, John, I don't want to shoot anybody.
Yes.
That mentality's gone now.
Yeah.
And one reason is because policemen have qualified immunity now. 99% of the times when they commit what we might call a crime, they cannot be charged. And if there's a monetary victory for the so-called client, the client's family, it's us, the taxpayer, that pays. In fact, there's a couple policemen have come out now and said the way to reduce some of this police actions would be to hold the policemen actually monetarily liable, and they might back off and not be so quick to pull the gun and shoot unarmed citizens.
Well, yeah, although I'm always skeptical of things that happen afterwards. If a policeman's probably not going to think about the consequences of these actions, it seems to me that better training is the answer.
Better training is the way to do it, yes.
Like in Dallas, where they had the unfortunate shooting of, I think, 5 policemen at a Black Lives Matter protest.
Yeah.
One of the ironies was that Dallas had actually done a lot of retraining of their policemen, and their public complaints and the number of police shootings had dropped dramatically, which shows just how much difference training could make.
It works, but most police departments, you can't get them to budge. You know, I've tried. In fact, I've helped some police departments write constitutional guidelines, how to teach the Fourth Amendment to their officers, and there are some that are trying, yes.
Right. I mean, is it just ignorance, or like what are the reasons why police forces get more and more militaristic that treat their own citizens?
A lot of it goes back to money, in my opinion. There's a lot of money to be made off the equipment, those kind of things. The federal government's doing a lot of the training now. The military's actually helping train some, you know, in the academies, which I think is a mistake. We shouldn't live in a military state in America now. In fact, George Washington, all the founding fathers of this country, warned against what they called a standing army. They said, you don't want that. We faced it. But we do have a standing army in this country. It's the militarized police, along with the local police, along with the federal agencies. Like I said, they're armed to the hilt now. I mean, you got the Smithsonian Institution, the FDA with SWAT teams and armored units. Something's going on.
And I know the FDA has used them, because I read that there's a cancer doctor in Houston, Dr. Brzezinski, who's managed to withstand basically a multi-decade assault by the FDA, and it included at one point the SWAT team coming in to seize all his records.
Yeah, and you know, the Drug Enforcement Agency is actually doing SWAT team raids for overdue loans.
Loans? Why would they be having a raid for an overdue loan?
That's happened. It's just really weird. I document them in my books. But what I'm seeing is a lot of crazy things. Let me give you a case that kind of illustrates where we're at in America,
sure.
And we're seeing more of this. We defended a Marine named Brandon Robb several years ago. He came back from Afghanistan. He was not happy with what he saw, and he was posting stuff on his website saying Obama should be basically tried for treason. He didn't like Obama's executive orders on a number of things. He was playing a private video game called Mr. Illuminati, his brother and sister, and the FBI actually tapped into that, read it. One day he was at home working. He didn't own a weapon, by the way, no rifle or anything like that. The most dangerous thing he told me was his paring knife that he cut his fruit up in the morning. He just got back from jogging. He was sitting in his home, no shirt on, his jogging shorts. He heard some noise outside, clicking, and he heard vehicles. He went to his front door. About eight vehicles would pull up around his small house.
Right.
He saw SWAT teams running toward his house and guys, women and men in plain clothes, the black outfits. They were the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and several other agencies. They told him they were concerned about his Facebook posts. And he said he was kind of boggled. He said, why? He says, I mean, I have a First Amendment right. He said, why are you? And they asked him to step outside. He did. They grabbed him. They handcuffed him. He was arguing. He didn't resist. They argued. They slammed him against the fence and cut his back really badly. He got to the local police station. It was in Virginia. And he asked for a bandage. They put one of those prison shirts on him. He said it hurt so bad it went in the crack of his back. He had a five-minute examination in a police cell. The psychiatrist said, because of his long pauses and a few other things, this is a five-minute examination. He was mentally ill. He had a short hearing after that, and he was put in the mental hospital. We filed a lawsuit. He got out. We got him out in 7 days. The judge really shouldn't have been there. But here's the amazing thing I found out during that. These are called civil commitments in the United States. Mm-hmm. There are 1.5 million that occur each year.
1.5 million?
Well, I
think there's 25,000
alone in Virginia each year.
I mean, I can understand that. I mean, especially before mass shootings, there's often been Facebook postings and things like that. Then in retrospect, you would say this was a problem. Of course, the fact is there's millions of similar postings of which most people don't go and do anything. You can see somebody coming to his house and saying, can we talk about what you're writing on Facebook, et cetera.
Yes. I mean, this is a veteran, a decorated veteran. He took rifles. He went through the minefields and removed mines to protect the troops.
Wow.
This is how they treated him when he came back.
Yeah.
The question is, he was totally not guilty. I know him today. He's a hip-hop artist. He's doing pretty good. Normal guy. He's just an outspoken. The First Amendment in this country says you have a right to speak out against the government.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the strongest parts of American society.
About a year ago, a veteran came in to see me. He started crying. I said, what's wrong? He was, a veteran. He had fought for the country and all that. He came back. He said he had done a post about some operations in his community, nothing violative of any orders or anything. The NSA showed up the next day with weapons and told him if he did any more posts like that, they would deport him from the country. We backed the NSA off. It's Ruff Institute. This is happening. We get a lot of veterans cases, very strange stuff. But they're watching everything that you're posting on Facebook, Twitter, email.
Right.
And they're doing what they call threat assessments in the country. The Department of Homeland, you get a threat assessment from green to red, depending on your post, and then you get visited by an agent. I've had talk show hosts, by the way. We've defended talk show hosts.
Right.
Who go on the air and they'll say, Hillary Clinton should be arrested. One did. He went home that night.
Right.
And around his door was a little post that said, the FBI wants an interview with you. We backed the FBI off. They can't do that. A lot of people give in, and they're intimidated, and they shut up.
You'd think there'd be some common sense, because if a talk show host said somebody should go out and deal with, to get rid of Hillary or Trump, I mean, that could be a death threat, right? But if somebody says she should be arrested, then that's a legal opinion.
They're watching everything, what I'm saying. With these threat assessments now, we get the cases, and I mean, it's crazy. They're doing algorithms of all your text. They're watching it. There's now a so-called sentiment assessment. They look at your semantics to see if they can. This is pre-crime. If you haven't seen the movie, I'd say look at Minority Report. There was a great author named Philip K. Dick who wrote about all this stuff. He predicted it. He was against it. He said that pre-crime's coming where you'll be rounded up for not committing a crime, but just speaking out against the government. And it's happening in some countries.
I mean, one thing you mentioned, which is actually quite scary, is the fact that these threat assessments are not done by humans, or at least the majority.
It's
computer. And it's really impossible. I'm a computer programmer myself. I understand there are some things you cannot do with computers, and you cannot put in words of a human being or other aspects of them, their body temperature or whatever. You can't put that into an algorithm and come up with a reliable answer. You will identify millions of Americans as potential threats, and you'll miss a lot of people who are true threats. So it's completely futile.
I had a former NSA agent tell me that. He met with me. He's, he likes my stuff. He says, you're right about what's going on. He said, here's the problem, John. By watching everybody, we don't get the real people. We're watching everybody. Everybody's being watched, studied by the computer system. And he said that the NSA's Utah facility, which is basically the big one in the United States, he says it's the computers that deliver the messages to the agents and send them out. He says that's scary. Again, it's not human beings. I mean, if you look at a guy like this Marine who defended his country, pro-American and all that stuff, and you send a SWAT team and slam him against the fence and put him in a mental hospital, that's a computer. And the average person showing up at the door, the average policeman, doesn't even have a college education. So you're not dealing with people who are dealing in analytical stuff. They don't understand. They just know I've been sent to get this guy.
I mean, that's wrong on so many levels. I mean, it's a severe over-escalation. An interview might be justified, but you don't need to interview somebody with a SWAT team. In fact, how can you?
Well, I'm saying 80% of the SWAT team raids in America today are for mere warrant service where a cop used to show up and knock on your door. There's no threat.
I mean,
people are getting shot. I mean, here's the thing. I did an article, and it's even on our website. They're shooting 500 dogs a day in this country sometimes.
They're what?
They always execute the dogs. And by the way, I deal with postmen. Postman said, hey, I don't know why the cops shoot all the dogs in these raids and stuff. He says, I just back them off. And again, I'm a dog lover. I deal with dogs.
Right.
You don't have to shoot a poodle.
Right. I guess when your only tool is a gun, then...
Bang. Well, no, they're trained militarily. When they enter that home, it's a military occupation now.
Right.
They're in black outfits. By the way, I show in my book, Battlefield America, once they put the uniforms on and the gear, your whole psychology changes. You become a different person.
Yes.
Than the guy used to dress in that brown outfit who didn't carry a gun.
Yet. Right.
The old Andy Griffith show, if people could go back and watch a few episodes of that, it was the way law enforcement was in the 1960s. It was a guy in a brown uniform who didn't like guns, who didn't think violence was the answer to how to deal with it. And 99% of the time, listen, I talk to good cops today who tell me, listen, John, I've learned one thing. When I see someone on the street corner who's kind of a rebel and he's yelling and stuff, I go up and shake his hand and say, I agree, your First Amendment rights, settle down, buddy, and walk off, and he said, that's it.
I mean, I think de-escalation and community involvement definitely are things that should be brought back. Anyway, we've kind of run out of time for this interview. If there's anything else you'd really like to get out before we close,
I'm a civil liberties attorney, 40 years. I've been working in this area. I am really concerned about the future of the country. And if people don't really get their act together, as I show in Battlefield America, you can do it. Martin Luther King did it. A lot of great activists changed the face of the country, nonviolently, by the way, peacefully. But they were organized, they had strategy, and they got their act together and kept at it. They didn't give up.
And if you're
give up today.
If your political involvement is just going out to vote, that's not enough.
It will not work, no.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Martin Luther King said that. He basically
said
the political, it ain't going to work. What's going to work is, he said the government doesn't listen to us. And they listen to people in numbers who they know are concerned, and nonviolence is the way to do it.
But nonviolent civil disobedience.
Yes.
Because if you obey the rules, then you'll never get anywhere.
I agree.
Thank you very much for joining me today, John. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye. And now there's time to review a little bit of the news. Huffington Post is shocked, horrified, that American Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, who is a medical doctor, has minor concerns about vaccination. Quoting from the Huffington Post, August the 2nd of this year. In a video interview with the Washington Post last Friday, Stein said that while vaccines have played an important role in keeping us healthy and safe, there are legitimate concerns about how those vaccines are approved and regulated. I think there's no question that vaccines have transformed public health and have been absolutely critical in ridding us of the scourge of many diseases, such as smallpox, polio, etc. So vaccines are an invaluable medication, Stein said. Like any medication, they should also be approved by a regulatory board that people can trust. In a comments mirror statement she made during a Reddit Ask Me Anything forum in May, where she described corporate influence over U.S. vaccine regulation as, quote, foxes guarding the chicken coop, claiming regulatory boards are routinely packed with corporate lobbyists and CEOs. So the Huffington Post, being balanced on this issue, quotes Dr. Paul Offit, without mentioning that he's replete with huge conflicts of interest, including having patented, I believe, a rotavirus vaccine and profited from it. Offit says, where is the evidence that corporate influence has caused either the FDA or the CDC to make decisions to hurt American children? That statement is just so incredible as to be laughable. What this Huffington Post article illustrates is that while the mainstream press will sometimes allow comments and criticisms on pharmaceutical drugs, they will not allow the same on vaccines. Dr. Jill Stein is hardly asking tough questions about vaccines. She could go a lot further, and I think that she should. But can you imagine the furor that would occur if she questioned the need for all of the vaccines that children are exposed to, for example? Right now, with no liability for the damage that vaccines cause and a pliable Centers for Disease Control that both approves vaccines and also essentially markets them, purchases them, and then distributes them, it's very easy to get a vaccine added to the schedule. But I think we've probably gone beyond the point of no return for a lot of American children. And vaccines definitely do have side effects. In Japan, the Japan Times in March of this year reported, the victims suffering side effects from cervical cancer vaccines, once recommended by the government, announced they will file a lawsuit against the state and drug makers. Many victims are still suffering from side effects of the HPV vaccines Cervarix and Gardasil. These side effects include overall pain and disorders of perception, movement, and memory, lawyer Masumi Minaguchi, a representative from the planned lawsuit's defense team, told a news conference in Tokyo. He said the lawsuit would be filed sometime after June against the central government, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck Sharp, and Dome at four district courts in Japan. Currently, 12 plaintiffs are taking part in the suit, but more are being looked for. One of them, Nanami Sakai, is a 21-year-old who was given Cervarix twice in 2011. She said she did not receive information about the pros and cons of the vaccine before receiving the injections. And she now spends a lot of time in a wheelchair. She says she has numbness in the right side of her body, back, and around her chest. It should be pointed out that it's estimated that only 1 to 10% of adverse reactions ever get reported to voluntary adverse reaction reporting systems. It's not clear whether it would be that dramatically different in Japan. Another plaintiff is Yui Taniguchi, a 17-year-old high school student who suffers from severe headaches and occasional loss of vision. She decided to join the suit in order to show that there are many people whose lives have been turned upside down by the vaccines. According to Japanese health ministry figures, 2,022 people suffered side effects out of an estimated 2.5 million who had received injections of Cervarix by the end of 2014. Out of the Gardasil recipients, 790,000 recipients, 453 experienced side effects. It's important to note that reporting systems for adverse effects of drugs or vaccines or anything else are generally estimated to pick up only between 1 and 10% of the actual adverse reactions. Sometimes doctors will persuade patients that the adverse reactions are caused by something else. People won't think they're important enough. They can't be bothered. They don't know how. There are many reasons why adverse reactions don't get reported. Thank you for listening to episode 112 of The Infectious Myth. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for a future guest, please email me at davidcrow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.